This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a birthday party for political prisoner Reverend Edward Pinckney. And what does it mean when the whole ruling class lines up behind one presidential candidate? But first, Washington, D.C. is the site this weekend for a national Black political convention on self-determination. The event was organized by the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, which has rallied and marched on the White House every November since President Obama's first year in office. Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshitela says Black is Back is determined to put Black self-determination back on the agenda.
I think it's really important to remember that right now everybody's talking about Trump and Hillary. But 7 years ago, when we founded the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations, everybody was talking about Barack Hussein Obama. And in many ways, some people saw it as the end of history, you know, like with the election of Obama, that's it. You know, for some, we had reached the pinnacle of the aspirations of a certain sector of the Black population, and others couldn't imagine a good future given how successful the rulers have been in pawning off Obama to our communities. But the Black and Black Coalition was right on time then, and it's on time now, because here we are in a situation where people are not just talking about Hillary and Trump, but people are expressing in many different ways the crisis that the whole system is facing and confronted right now. And it doesn't even matter too much which of these candidates ends up winning the election in terms of what it means for the system itself, that it's not something that's going to be easy to recover from, if possible at all. So you see the entire system in a state of absolute disarray, and the coalition is pushing forward our own agenda. You have white people who are openly talking about the possibility of revolution if Trump doesn't get elected. You hear people who are exposing to the marrow just the corruptness of the Clinton regime. And I don't even know if you can call it corrupt as such, because it's just typically a capitalist, and all of the covers are being pulled off the venal nature of the social system itself. And people really running around, a lot of people running around trying to see their way through this process. And the Black is Back Coalition is offering at least our community and people who are interested in a genuine transformation an opportunity to do that with the Black People's Convention that's going to be happening in Washington, D.C. on November 5th and 6th, beginning at Malcolm X Park on Saturday, November 5th, with a rally, leaving their march on the White House, another rally across the street from the White House. And this will give so many people an opportunity to address the conditions and the needs and the issues that are confronting Black people in this country. Hopefully, we'll have a lot of family members of people who have been gunned down, killed by police, otherwise brutalized, imprisoned, et cetera, on both these days. And there was no room for these people at either the Democratic or the Republican convention. They will have an opportunity to express these issues before other people at the Black People's Convention. And then, of course, we will be using this to unveil the Black political agenda for self-determination for Black people in the 19 points, the declaration that we are making to the world, so that at the end of that convention, which will end on the 6th, 2 days later, of course, the person who will become the next figure for U.S. imperialism will be determined by the election. And I feel that we will have an opportunity, a grand opportunity on the 6th, to put forth our own agenda so that regardless of the outcome, African people do not have to be dispirited by what the Clinton or Trump refuse to do or say about our situation. We will have our own agenda, and we'll be able to forward that agenda in the world.
Could you talk about the significance of these 19 points? For the last two years of the Obama administration, we've seen the emergence of what hopefully will be a new and vital movement, but something's largely been missing, and that's the subject of self-determination and how to get there.
I think that's a critical point to make, because that's just so important that the coalition has done. And what makes it more important is the fact that it is a coalition, that it's a number of organizations and institutions and personalities that are involved in the struggle for the freedom of our people who have collectively determined that self-determination has to be on the agenda, because it has been absent. And in the absence of self-determination, any kind of politic has been something that's been advanced, and sometimes to the detriment of our community, and sometimes advanced by the very same Democratic Party that we are engaged and have been engaged and still struggle with for the longest period of time. Now we are talking about self-determination. It's not just hands up, don't shoot. It's not just Black Lives Matter, but we are talking about the right for our people to be a self-determining people. And if you examine history, even though we've gone through in this country the thing they call slavery, the thing they call Jim Crow, the thing they've called segregation and desegregation, the fundamental thing that we've been confronted with is the loss of self-determination as a people. And whatever it's called, whether it's called slavery, whether it's called integration, whether it's called Jim Crow, the missing element has been the right of our people to be a self-determining people. And that's the thing that's so critical with what we're doing now. And that's also the thing that distinguished the struggle of our people in the 1960s, where at the height of the revolutionary movement in the world, not only in the United States, self-determination, that was the thing on the agenda, whether it was being something that was being propelled, the man being propelled by the people in Vietnam. The Cubans had just succeeded in realizing that and was trying to do what they could to influence the movement for self-determination throughout South America and even on the continent of Africa. And Black people on the continent of Africa and in this country were demanding self-determination. That's what we were fighting for at the moment that U.S. government unleashed a whole counterinsurgency that assassinated a lot of people, imprisoned a lot of people, and then placed in the stead of the leadership that existed, much of the leadership that existed then, this new category of people, some of whom have been characterized as a misleadership class, but, you know, who we say is just a rabidly self-interested African petty bourgeois force. And they have been what has been substituting for leadership, and they have not been interested in self-determination.
Yes, people do mention the term self-determination, but what does it mean when it comes to police and mass incarceration and gentrification and jobs and such? These 19 points address self-determination in all of these areas of struggle.
It does that. And what it does, it gives the beginning of some kind of plan. It makes it a material reality as opposed to some empty declaration and empty aspiration. It says specifically, here's our view on the question of reparations. Here's our view about the question of Black women. Here's how we see the question of the police invasion and brutality in our community, about the what people are characterizing mass incarceration. We say turn them loose. At minimum, turn them loose. We say free the political prisoners. We want the political prisoners free. We talk about economic development. I mean, this gives meat to the concept that people, you know, have been able to embrace at some juncture as a concept, as an abstract concept, but this puts meat on the bones. And I think that's really important. And what's, I think, most important about this is, again, it's a number of organizations. It's not just some narrow position or something that might be considered a narrow position that reflects an ideological perspective coming from one organization, but a lot of different organizations and a lot of different political trends and tendencies have been able to say that what is the final analysis, the determining factor, is practice. And pulling together the coalition and then practice, what does it look like, this thing that we call self-determination? And I think that's been really important, and it's going to make all the difference in the world moving forward.
And what use do you envision this document will be put to?
Well, I think the thing that is good about it is that it arms everybody, not just the people who participate in the coalition, but as wild as we can get this distributed and people talking about it, it will inform and influence how they move. I mean, got to remember, we're talking about people coming out of this electoral season absolutely dissatisfied with the choices that they've had. absolutely dissatisfied with the fact that nobody spoke to the interests of African people and that there has been no single organization that's been capable of capturing the imagination and of the masses of our people. And now we're talking about these 19 points that can be embraced by the masses in general, and this is something that will be used by folk who may continue to be Democrats, but it places pressure on the Democratic Party to adopt these 19. If not all 19, we're going to find people for whom some parts of the agenda will be more significant than other parts. But I think that it's something that also existing organizations can embrace and carry it out as their own, and also organizations, I suspect, will be formed. New organizations in this era of growing consciousness and activism inside our community, it lays out a platform that hasn't existed for a very long time for our people.
And of course, this will be the eighth year in a row that the Black Is Back Coalition has descended upon Washington and marched to the White House.
It will be the eighth year in a row. And Obama said that he wanted people to give him a righteous send-off. And he said that from the perspective of everybody go out and vote for Hillary Clinton. But we say it from the perspective that the masses need to be able to demonstrate righteous indignation. A Democrat has not simply been somebody who represents the interests of the white rulers of this country, but he's been a traitor to Black people. And I think that this is going to be a magnificent opportunity for all of these people who've been wounded and maimed over the last 8 years by white power and capitalism in general will have an opportunity to stand up, and people will come carrying photos of their family members and friends who have been killed and jailed, and banners representing what we see as our interests and calling for reparations, demanding reparations. And this at a time where the Democrats and the Republican parties in some ways are imploding, in some ways the establishment imploding, and neither of them able not only to speak to the interests of Black people, but they can't even come up with an agenda that speaks to white people. The deterioration of the political dialogue in this country is such that to say anything exposes the crisis of imperialism, and so therefore it's resulted in just a battery of name-calling and silliness about who's sleeping with whom and whether somebody felt up a white woman or not, even as the U.S. government is murdering women and children all over the Middle East and in Africa. And in this country, when you look at what they're doing to the impoverished communities, not only of our folk, but you look at what's happening in North Dakota with the pipeline struggle and what have you. We are offering through the coalition a genuine response inside this country to what U.S. imperialism, the crisis that U.S. imperialism is experiencing now. We are offering a coherent response to that. And anybody who wants to can take this agenda. They can run with this agenda. They don't have to be in any particular party, or they can be in any particular party that they want to. And this agenda can guide their demands, and it can guide their participation in political life in this country at this critical moment.
Black Is Back Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshitela. Much of the world would agree that the current U.S. presidential campaign is one of the strangest in modern times. Not only did the Republicans and Democrats nominate the nation's two most unpopular politicians, but the election is occurring when the entire capitalist system is in crisis. We spoke with Dr. Anthony Montero, the Du Boisian scholar with the Black Radical Organizing Committee.
You cannot understand adequately what is happening if the focus is only upon events and scandals and personalities. We have to look at what is happening in large and broad historical terms. And I would suggest that we are entering a new moment, a new period in American history. Some social scientists refer to a crisis like the one that we're in, and it is a crisis, as a crisis of systemic breakdown. What Karl Marx called, using the Latin phrase, a momenti mori, a reminder of death. This is a general crisis seeking resolution. The country is divided, as much as it was divided in 1860 when Lincoln was elected, and the next year the country was in a civil war. I don't think this election will end on November 8th. This will continue. The battle that defined this election will continue for some time going forward.
Well, there are a lot of breakdowns to talk about. There's a breakdown in international relations with the threat of war, bigger than I think any time in my lifetime. We have a breakdown in the capitalist economy, which hasn't been able to get past 2% growth for about a decade. And we have a very clear and obvious breakdown in the duopoly electoral system. And that's just to name three breakdowns.
And you're right about the breakdown in the international system and a reconfiguring of alliances, creating new alliances. And most dramatic in the most recent period has been the Philippines and its president, Duterte, who has done a 180 degrees and has gone from a military and political ally of the United States to a military and political ally of China. Now, on the European front, I think, and this is a prediction, that we will see Turkey realign, perhaps not as dramatically as what we're seeing in the Philippines, but Turkey could very well realign away from NATO towards Russia. This will create a historic crisis in the 70-year-old NATO and Asian security systems, and I put quotes around security systems, established by the United States after World War II.
Certainly, Turkey is important to the U.S. goal of encircling both Russia and China.
And key to the plans to overthrow the Assad government in Syria as a step towards war with Iran and possibly Russia. So yes, absolutely.
The corporate media seldom mentions that not only was the Philippines a close military ally, as you said, of the United States, but it was a colony of the United States until 1946. They don't like to use that word in terms of U.S. relations in the world.
And became a neo-colony after that. And what the current government in the Philippines is doing is breaking all of the neo-colonial ties, realigning itself with both China and Russia. Now, what will the impact of that be upon the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I think will be dead on arrival when it's taken to the Congress, or however the Obama administration wishes or hopes to push it through. But this is huge. This is huge. It's not just domestic. It is also international. And when it occurs in this fashion, in both domestic and international relationships, it is a moment of truth for the ruling class, for the ruling elite. What do? When they're trumped at home, forgive the pun, and trumped internationally, what do? Do they back off of empire? Do they readjust? Do they become peaceful? Or do they up the stakes and attempt to resolve all problems with war abroad and repression at home? That's what we'll have to see.
Well, many believe that the United States has assumed this more and more aggressive military posture because it can't kickstart this capitalist economy.
Yeah, I mean, that's one explanation of it, that there are economic benefits to war, including domestic political benefits by focusing all of the concern and energy of the people against a foreign power, a foreign enemy. I don't know that that'll work this time. I think the 2016 election has kind of taken the question of uniting the nation behind war, especially if Clinton is elected. It has made that very, very difficult because she does not have the legitimacy to be a wartime president. The people and ordinary people and ordinary white people, ironically, would rebel against any decision that she makes to carry out a policy of regime change in Russia, the Philippines, or Syria. That is the dilemma that they face. I don't think they have answers to this problem.
But do they have any choice? If they're going to be an empire, they must project power. And if their economic power is waning, the only other power they can project is military.
That's one way of looking at it. The other option, and this is the bitter pill for them, is to withdraw or retreat from empire, to realign its ambitions in line with a multipolar world. This whole idea of the single indispensable nation, of a single superpower, of the capacity to have dominance in two major wars and in a minor war, what they call full-spectrum domination. All of this, their military doctrines, their policies of economic domination using the dollar and the petrodollar, all of this is collapsing. You know, one big thing that happened last week is that Russia is now China's main supplier of petroleum and petroleum products. And they have agreed that they would not trade in these commodities using the dollar. They will use the yuan, the renminbi, the Chinese currency. This ups the Chinese currency as a major international currency in trading relations and lowers the profile of the dollar, especially for the strategic commodity of oil.
Well, Trump is clearly going to go down in flames, but the issues that he raised in terms of a U.S. foreign policy that was not aimed at regime change and that did look towards more agreements and discussions with Russia and with China, that doesn't go away.
No, it doesn't. And I don't know that he's going to go down in flames. Even if he loses, he won't go down in flames. He has rendered a great service to the people of the United States by taking a wrecking ball to the Republican Party. I think part of the consequence of his campaign and his populism is to have really destroyed the Republican Party as a national mechanism. There's some speculation that it might effectively break up into three parties. But the two-party duopoly is also going down. I don't think the, and I put quotes, progressive wing of the Democratic Party will ever return to a Clinton neoliberal, neocon dominated party. And so they're going to have to find another mechanism if they intend to remain involved in politics. But I think bigger than the political electoral system will be the urges to build new movements based upon the growing protests around the country from North Dakota to Charlotte, North Carolina, to wherever you go in this country. There's stirrings of anger and protest against the existing system, be it economic questions, environmental questions, police brutality. So more than anything, we are looking at the potentiality of a new movement, a new synthesis, a new ideological clarity that will operate against the existing political leadership of the country, including the black misleadership class, but will at the same time act against the system itself and push increasingly for a new economic and social system that puts the people before the profits of the financial oligarchs and the multinational corporations.
It is noteworthy that the movement for Black Lives did not get sucked into endorsing the Democratic Party or any political party this season.
Yeah, I think it's very important. And I would hope that it moves forward with its agenda, which is a reform agenda, radical in some ways, liberal in others. But I think that agenda has to be pushed. But the Black Lives Movement cannot become self-centered and egotistical and not understand that it must be part of something much larger and far broader than itself. And thus, the question raised on this 50th anniversary of the Black Panther Party, raised by the great leader of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton, we have to look forward to rainbow coalitions based upon a program of action and increasingly a program directed against the system itself, the centers of political and economic power in the country. There must be that unraveling. And that does not have to happen. And I don't think it will happen in one blow or a number of single blows. It will be a process of takedown, often starting in local areas where people's power and institutions of people's power will be organized and assert themselves against the powerful.
Well, certainly the center of power is the banks, and the next president, which will be Hillary Clinton, is a politician as closely identified with the banks as anyone.
That's right. And so that's why we're talking about a new action synthesis, new unity, a new rainbow coalition. But, and this is the key, a new level of ideological clarity. Who is the enemy of the people? What are its institutions? Who are the personalities and politicians and leaders that represent the enemies of the people? And what must the people do to take their power back from their enemies? Those are questions that will be discussed throughout this country in the broadest terms. And therefore, we're talking about new forms of coalition, new forms of politics of the people, which is different than electoral politics. It is a politics of action, a politics of organization, a politics of focusing upon the enemy and doing everything possible to limit the power of the enemy and ultimately to eliminate them as the force that operates against the people and to undermine their interests.
While we were talking about this new era, and what is different about this era is that most of the enemies that you're speaking of are now huddled in one big tent, Hillary Clinton's big tent. And that may not just be an electoral phenomenon.
No, it's not. It's a phenomenon of government. I mean, what you see in this so-called Democratic big tent, the Hillary Clinton big tent, this is, in microcosm, the way they see governance or governing the country at this time and how they see the coalition among the ruling elites that is necessary to reassert hegemony and empire in the world. So this is not just to elect Hillary Clinton. This is about the way they see governance. And of course, that is the target of the people's movement. And it must be a popular movement. Let me just say this. You know, there are all kinds of seductions. And one of the greatest seductions of the people's movement is to go into forms of sectarianism and dogmatism under the guise of radical theory. That is a huge mistake. You know, and even as we fight for ideological clarity, and especially the political education of the broadest mass of people, we must not precondition the unity of the people based upon ideological conditions or putting ideology ahead of the practical struggle for unity of the people and to progress against the forces, really, of fascism and of war.
Well, you're going to have to break that down, Doctor. What do you mean and who are you talking about?
I'm saying that there are tendencies among inexperienced, especially young people, to associate forms of leftism with a kind of dogmatic Marxism or even Trotskyism that used for, and this is a quote again, ideological purity against the practical needs of the struggle. And I am saying that There is no such thing as ideological purity. That's an illusion. It's an illusion of those who do not have the practical experience of people's struggles. But even if there were such a thing, you could not put ideology ahead of the political needs of uniting the people. We want ideological clarity, but in the broadest sense, not in a narrow sense. I guess I would use another word, vanguardism, this pushing and shoving among little leftist groups about who is going to be in front and who is the smartest and who is the vanguard of the people. And at the same time, the people who are doing all of that have no organic or substantive relationships with the people.
Well, we're speaking of the politics of folks who are on the left and engaged in social movements, but what about the labor movement, which is still aligned with those same Democratic Party forces for the most part?
Well, yep, and this is a big problem. We're talking about a bureaucratic labor aristocracy who are at the top doing quite well in this big tent. We're also talking about a group of parasitic black misleaders who are also in the big tent. But the masses of working people, who, by the way, are not being organized by unions of any type for the most part, are doing worse and worse and worse. And that is why, I mean, on the one side, it looks like Hillary Clinton is going to, you know, roll to a smashing victory. But it's predicated upon the labor movement spending tens of millions of dollars to get the vote out on Election Day. And I would suggest that the masses of organized working people, or masses of them, will defy their leadership and either stay home, vote for a third party, or vote for Donald Trump. I think there's going to be a rank-and-file rebellion within the labor movement against their leadership. I think the same thing with black people. You go into any black community in this country, there is no excitement about this election. You would not know that there was an election, for the most part, in many communities. People are uninterested, they're unexcited, and they do not trust the choices that they have. They are turned off to the two-party duopoly, and in fact, to the system that sustains this duopoly.
Now, in December, you're holding an event that's going to tackle some of these burning issues that you've been outlining.
Yes, we are. And it's entitled Revolutionary Science for Radical Times, Engaging Logic, Knowledge, and Action. And we want to begin to look at the intellectual, ideological, and political needs of the people of this country going forward, and to think in broad terms about the production of knowledge from the standpoint of the working people and their struggles. We want to take back the initiative of intellectual and knowledge production from academics and universities. And I would say to you, most academics out the gate are compromised. They're compromised because they're careerists. They're compromised because universities say to them, especially when they're at the elite ones, that either you play by the game or you will be thrown out. They're compromised by the fact that they have never been connected to any mass movement. And what we're saying is a new type of intellectual, an organic intellectual, a new type of activist, a revolutionary activist, a new type of thinker, one who is rooted in ideological struggle and the fight for ideological clarity. And that's what we hope to begin to frame as the start of a process towards a new type of movement leadership.
And so we wouldn't just be talking about intellectuals as those who write books.
Absolutely, Glenn. In fact, we are going in the opposite direction. Our position is that, as you put it, those who write books are usually those who don't know much about the suffering and misery of ordinary people. It is very clear that most of those who write books never join a picket line, never set up a school, a Saturday free school, or anything for ordinary people. They are elitists. In fact, most people who write books, especially from the academic institutions, are themselves either part of the Black misleadership class and hence parasitic among ordinary people, or they are apologists for the Black misleadership class and their parasitic behavior.
That was Dr. Anthony Monteiro speaking from Philadelphia. If you believe the U.S. corporate media, then you probably think that the people of Venezuela are starving and that most of them are out in the streets demanding the head of President Nicolas Maduro and the overthrow of his Socialist Party government. But is any of that true? We asked Dr. George Cicariello Marr, who teaches politics at Drexel University and is author of the book We Created Chavez, A People's History of the Venezuelan Revolution.
Well, the only slightly accurate part I would say is that there is a deep economic crisis going on in Venezuela, but we need to go a lot deeper to figure out where it is coming from and what the actual situation on the ground is. You know, Venezuela for a century has been deeply dependent on oil. Chavismo sought to counteract this and had some limited success, but the country remains very dependent on oil. So, you know, when the global oil prices collapsed as a result of many factors, the political impact on Venezuela is, you know, coming precisely through this economic collapse, which is making it very difficult for people to get access to especially imported goods. And many, many goods are very expensive. There's been a dramatic increase in corruption in various sectors of the private sector and public. There's a great deal of speculation, smuggling, and black market activity that is driving up prices and making it difficult for people to get the goods that they need. Now, politically, it's kind of astonishing, and this is the same during the oil lockout by the oil executives in 2002 and 2003. What's surprising is that it's not that the vast majority has abandoned the government, although the support for Nicolas Maduro, his popularity has certainly dropped because of the very difficult economic situation. But you have an opposition that is sort of smelling blood in the water, getting excited, and attempting to use its legislative victory in the December 2015 elections as a way to really just wipe out the other branches of government. You know, they have one branch, and this week they attempted to pass a statement saying that they were questioning and calling into question Maduro's legitimacy as the president, attempting to overturn his presidency and to dissolve the Supreme Court. So you have some very aggressive moves coming this week by the Venezuelan opposition.
Yes, because of the constitutional changes, a president in Venezuela can be recalled, but they haven't succeeded in doing that yet.
Absolutely true. And what we need to remember when we hear things like this week in particular, several very loud voices saying that finally Venezuela is a dictatorship, we should remember that, first of all, people have been calling this a dictatorship for a long time and it has never been one. Second of all, if the right to recall the president is the mark of a dictatorship, then everything was a dictatorship before Chavez came to power and the Constitution was rewritten. And finally, there's a way to recall the president. There's a way to recall all elected leaders in Venezuela. And it's one of the most dramatic and radical constitutions in the world in that respect, but you have to go through the right steps. And so what happened this week, what is being portrayed as the final step into dictatorship, was very minor in some ways. Several lower courts called for a halt to the moving forward of the referendum against Maduro because they claimed that 300,000 or hundreds of thousands of signatures are invalid, and these were identified previously, but it was lower courts that stepped in to halt the process, and the Electoral Council has heeded those calls and put it on hold until they can investigate. Now, that sounds a lot like the institutions working their way out. It doesn't sound like a collapse into dictatorship. And it also is very interesting because this opposition claims repeatedly that the government refuses the separation of powers and has totally taken over the judiciary, et cetera. But here are lower court rulings that the opposition themselves claim we should just refuse to recognize and move forward with a referendum, despite how many illegal signatures of children, signatures of dead people that they put on the rolls to get get this moving. The reality, though, is that they will likely get these signatures. I mean, there are that many people frustrated with how bad the economy is that they will likely move forward on this referendum. There was a referendum in 2004 and Chavez won. And there was a question about it because the economy had some very tough moments in which his popularity dropped. And so I think only time will tell whether or not the Maduro government is able to stabilize itself in such a way as to be able to win a referendum. Because if they lose prior to January of 2017, there will be a snap election for a new president. If Maduro loses a referendum after January, then the vice president will take over for the next 2 years.
A salient point of the crisis is, of course, the shortage, the artificial shortage of goods. But how is it that after all these years of a socialist government, the private sector can have such a chokehold on the economy that it can create these shortages?
Well, the private sector does have a very powerful chokehold. We should be clear about that. And has actively sabotaged the economy, has actively contributed to shortages, has also done so in a very banal way in the sense that, you know, instead of selling things at the official price controlled rate so people can afford them, they sell them on the black market so that they can make more money. The question is not whether or not Venezuela is producing the things that it needs. It has not been, and it has not been for many decades. The question is, at what point did the import sector turn off the tap, in a sense, so that the government is handing millions and even billions of dollars in oil money to private companies to import goods? And at some point, many of those companies decided to keep the money or decided to speculate on the money and sell it on the black market or decided to buy the goods and then sell those on the black market. And this has become really epidemic in recent years. And even Chavez pointed to this danger when he said, and this is a quote, "We look like idiots handing millions of dollars over to the bourgeoisie, this kind of comprador, useless bourgeoisie that all they do is import and sell things." And yet the Venezuelan economy has remained so dependent that that has been the reality, that the government still turns to the private sector in an attempt to get the shelves filled. And many people on the left, you know, say, listen, that may be a short-term solution, but you're still granting this too much power to this private sector. And many bring the imports over to things like these local grassroots communes that are developing in a democratic way to make these kind of decisions instead of leaving that power in the hands of the private sector.
Yes, and I suppose the point is, just as clearly, Venezuela is not a dictatorship, or you would not have all of this dissent and the opposition in control of the legislature. It certainly is not a socialist government in control of the economy either, or else we wouldn't have these chokeholds strangling the economy and endangering the government itself.
That's absolutely true. What you have instead is a coexistence of different forms, not only simply capitalist or socialist, but different kinds of socialism even. The question of a state control of the economy versus kind of grassroots, self-managed sectors of the economy. And these all interact. I mean, these all coexist in a tense and contradictory way. And I think people should realize that it is no surprise to see the economy in pain at this point, because global capitalism does not like it when an economy deviates from the norm. Global capitalism will punish any economy that deviates from the norm. So, for example, you know, Venezuela is still paying millions, hundreds of million dollars out for expropriating things. And the reason that it has to pay that money out to foreign corporations is because if it doesn't, then it will get punished on the global market. It will get punished economically, financially, and be made to suffer more. And so, too, with the domestic economy, when you have price controls because you think people should be able to afford to eat, the economy punishes you. Private producers will refuse to produce, so they'll go to the black market. When you have price controls on gasoline, people start to smuggle it across the border and sell it for 100 times the value.
What have we learned from this crisis? What's the lesson or the way out? Is the government just going to tough it out until oil prices rise and hope that the legislature can be taken back in the next election cycle? Or has the Socialist Party learned some lessons about what kinds of changes in governance it has to institute if it gets the opportunity?
I think that's a good question. On the one hand, there are very real lessons about keeping the macroeconomy stable. So, for example, Bolivia was much more cautious in preparing for this kind of a storm and weathering it better. Venezuela could have heeded the advice of economists very early on to liberate a bit the exchange rate as a way of preventing the kind of economic spiral that's happened. Unfortunately, the government has lost and spent a great deal of political capital. So the question of survival is one question, but you no longer have the moment which you had in 2006, 2008, when Chavez Chavez could move the vast mass of Venezuelans in the direction of socialism, pressing toward a sort of the radical promise of a new kind of society. And my fear is that people have, in many ways, lost their faith in this new kind of vision because things have gotten very bad. Some of that will be gained back once stability returns, once the government takes some of the necessary measures, but also once the oil prices, of course, shoot back up. But, you know, it also needs to realize that the state itself is not necessarily the guarantor of socialism, and that without grassroots energy at the base, this project will not last long. Without an attempt to reinforce and support these experiments in grassroots democracy and socialist production on the local level, I worry that this process will founder and will ultimately not survive. And there are elections, regardless, there will be elections in a couple of years. And it's an open question whether or not the Socialist Party will be able to put forth a candidate that will be able to walk away with an electoral victory given these circumstances.
Yes, and you speak a great deal about the revolutionary fervor in some sectors of Venezuelan society, particularly among the folks in the communes. Would they accept the imposition of a right-wing government, a right-wing executive?
That is not entirely clear. And that's actually part of the strength of the communes, is the fact that what they're doing is seizing space. They're seizing territory. They're putting it into socialist self-government. And it would be very difficult for an opposition government to come in and throw them off of that land and attempt to shut down all these experiments at once. Now, that will certainly be what happens under a right-wing government. There'll be very quick moves to declare all of these communes, declare all of the expropriations illegal, and to return them to the private sector. But the struggle will come from there if that is what happens. And that's what is very interesting about these local grassroots organizations, that they're not betting on the elections. They're betting on their own ability to seize this space, to take it over, to build territory, much like, you know, what's going on in parts of the United States, of course, if we're talking about experiments in local self-governance, if we're talking about the Occupy movement, if we're talking about the Arab Spring and the way that people inserted themselves into the territory and attempted to hold it. And there's really no way of telling how that battle will unfold, but it's very reasonable, I think, that people, hundreds of thousands of people, are not willing to go back. They're not willing to step back. And that while they may accept a government taking power on the national level through a legitimate election, that doesn't mean that they're going to accept that that government is able to repress them like it did in the past, or able to take away from them the benefits that they have fought for and won over the past 20 years.
And finally, is Venezuela going to be able to continue extending those favorable oil export programs in terms to Cuba and to others of its neighbors?
Unfortunately, that has already begun to decline out of sheer necessity. And we're beginning to see not only the flip side of the amazing promise of Latin American and South American integration. The flip side of this is that when the pieces start to fall away, everything has the tendency to fall apart. So you have Argentina losing in an election to a very right-wing president. You have Brazil and Paraguay, governments being overthrown legislatively through these kind of quasi-coups that are happening. And at that point, Latin American solidarity on the left begins to get much weaker. And when you add to that the fact that Venezuela no longer can supply the cheap and even free oil that it was supplying to many countries, you have this very difficult situation where the political and the economic backing for that regional integration is beginning to dissipate. And so we've seen over the past 20 years the ability of a region to come together to support individual experiments on the local level and on the national level. But without that broader regional reinforcement, it's going to be very difficult for these countries to go it alone, whether it be Venezuela, Bolivia, or Ecuador, or others.
But what about the special relationship that has existed with Cuba?
That relationship, of course, continues. What's interesting is that Cuba is very strategically, and I think rightly, taking advantage of an opening with the United States, which will probably see the embargo lifted relatively soon. But the same week that the opening began with Cuba, new restrictions and new sanctions were imposed on Venezuela to placate the very right-wing Venezuelans that exist in that very same community in Miami. And so you've got a special relationship continuing, but the oil exports are decreasing. Cuba is realizing that it has to be a little more strategic when it comes to navigating these questions and is attempting to use the opening to support that. The solidarity is still there, but the financial backing and some of the sort of financial glue holding all this together is certainly suffering as a result of the downturn of the oil prices.
That was educator and author George Sicariello Marr. Political prisoner Reverend Edward Pinckney turned 68 years old this month, still serving a 2.5 to 10 year sentence on election tampering charges. Marcina Cole was a courtroom observer at Reverend Pinckney's trial in Benton Harbor, Michigan. She teamed up with David Soule of the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice to visit Pinckney in prison and to arrange a birthday party for him in Detroit.
It's very disturbing that they're locking so many prisoners in the state of Michigan and elsewhere across the nation for the sake of money. It's a big business. Let's make it clear, these privatization, when it comes down to the phones, usage, when it comes down as far as the care packages, you got to go through this outside source, and they're connected with the politicians and they're getting money. They all got money. That's why they're keeping people 40, 50 years in prison. You know, we have political prison, not only just Reverend Pinckney, but others as well, that won't even see daylight. So it's unfortunate and very disturbing when I see the little children that belong to some of the inmates that's there. So it's a struggle not only for just Reverend Pinckney, but others as well. And he's definitely behind bars in support of other inmates and doing ministry work. And he's looking forward to being out very soon. And we're doing the pressure. And I just want to say that it definitely helped that Ajamu Baraka, he went to visit Reverend Pinckney on the 19th of October on a Wednesday. I spoke to Ajamu on the Tuesday prior to that at Nandy's Knowledge Cafe, and we talked outside the cafe, and I gave him some information in reference to Reverend Pinckney's case. I'm pretty sure he had some, but he accepted that, and I also gave him the book, Soldiers of Truth, that was written by Phil Bassett. Mm-hmm. So anyway, his staff had got together and made some arrangements because he specifically wanted to, you know, see him. And it worked out. MDOC approved. I mean, you know, this was historical. You know, so they know how powerful Reverend Pinckney is because of the fact they allowed this visit to happen on a nut.
Yeah, they added Baraka onto the visiting list.
Right.
With only supposed to do it every 6 months. Mm-hmm. And they did it. They actually took my wife off his visiting list to make room, and now she's going to be put back on.
Yeah, in order for him to visit. And so that happened, I think around 2:30. Reverend Pinckney said they visited around 2:30 that afternoon, Wednesday, October the 19th. And he said they had a great conversation. And also the Muskegon News was there. And I did send you all the HTTP mail. I sent that to the 5920, where you all can click on it and you will see the actual interview. They did, a decent story about Reverend Pinckney, that he came to see a political prisoner. So, you know, that went across the country. So that's a good thing. And that brought up his spirits, too. So he definitely wants to get out of there because he's already want to work on a project, and so he wants to talk to me about that later. He says, we didn't get a chance to talk about 30. He says, I want you to come. We got to do something when I get out. So he's definitely anxious to get out, and we all are, specifically his wife. The great thing about it is not 500 miles away like Marquette from his wife and family.
90 miles.
So it's 90 miles. It's an hour and a half drive. I had Miss Pinckney wanted me to accompany her weeks ago, and I took a Greyhound bus there. And then the next morning, we went to Muskegon Heights. She does not like to drive alone, but nevertheless, it was only an hour and a half, and it's 2 hours and a half if you're from Detroit. So all the visits and the cards and the letters and the books, you know, David Soule sends to him and other people as well. That brings up his spirit and, of course, his faith, in God. So, you know, he remains strong. And it's not like it was where he had to watch his back when you're talking about the prison guards, because they were intimidating, harassing, you know, physically and mentally. So that's a good thing. He's much more, let's put it like this, more relaxed. And so, and I noticed, too, it's not as much tension. And they don't, you know, we don't have to take the paper off the food like we did before and show it to them and all this other stuff. I heat it up and take it straight to Reverend Pinckney. They don't do all that watching like they did at the other prisons, not just Marquette, but Lakeland, too. So we just want him to get out. We have a cake and celebration. I guess people say, why we're having, he's not here. But you know what? It's for him to see, and his wife. He's going to see the photo, not the video footage, but the photo. I want to thank Leona for coming here this evening, because I did ask her to come and film this great moment, you know, in connection with him. I love Reverend Pena, you know, and I'm supporting him, and not only just him, for all the others who've been locked up for no, you know, no justice, no peace, we say. So, you know, being locked up for no reason at all, and as you know, all white juries tend to lock a people of color up with no evidence across this country. So anyway, we got the cake here, and I've got cards for those who want to sign one. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Reverend Pinckney. Happy birthday to you. We love you, Reverend Pinckney. We love you, Mrs. Pinckney. We love all the supporters.
Tear down the walls.
Tear down the walls. Free all the political prisoners.
Free all the prisoners.
Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.